Hello and welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast, a show where we bring you insights from media industry experts to help journalists do their jobs better. I'm your host, Jacob Granger. Today is our last episode of 2024, so I thought we could reflect on some of the moments that defined the media business this year. Here to stew on this with me is a fellow media industry journalist, Simon Owens. He runs his own Substack newsletter, and he is the host of the Business of Content podcast. Simon is an all-round specialist on the creator economy, the publishing world, and traditional media. We'll be looking at some of the major expansions, closures, and acquisitions in the UK and the media industry, and drilling into what determines whether a media industry lives or dies going into 2025. The short answer is that you can't be tone deaf. Never has it mattered more for you to be led, or at least informed, by your audience. New players, from solo creators to media startups, understand this shift better than most traditional media. Is this a changing of the guard? Stay tuned to find out. Simon, welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast. It's a true pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. Big fan of your outlet. As you know, I link to it pretty regularly in my newsletter.
Yeah, and it's mutual because I've read so much of your work over the years. It's great to finally have a chance to be chatting face-to-face, reflecting on a bit of a crazy year. But how are things generally going on your side with all the sort of entrepreneurial solo stuff that you're working on?
It's going pretty well, I would say. So I've been kind of working on my own kind of media outlet for going on. I'm approaching my 5-year anniversary. I started in the beginning of 2020. And I would say like the first several years of that, I was more kind of focused on just growing the audience and finding, you know, what's the right content mix and stuff like that, and getting the right readers and the right listeners and the right viewers. By early 2024, I figured that out and got to a growth stage in terms of audience I really wanted to be in. So this year, my main kind of project was like, okay, I need to really double down on figuring out how to monetize everything I'm doing. And so I tried to like make a more kind of defined subscription strategy of like, this is what I'm offering to paid subscribers and stuff like that, and communicating that to my audience. So ever since I've done that, like the graph was like this, you know, in terms of like paid subscriptions.
Looks like a bit of a plateau for the people that can't see right now.
Sorry, I forgot this is the video version. It was in a plateau. And that was due to like, I was getting new paid subscribers, but the churn rate was causing it. So I wasn't really seeing growth. And I was just looking at the chart the other day, and there's definitely a very firm incline in growth in subscribers. So I figured I've slowly been figuring that part out.
Nice.
And then I'm starting to partner with a really experienced veteran B2B ad sales guy. So starting in 2025, really going to get more serious about selling sponsorships for my newsletter and podcast. So hopefully I'm on a good trajectory heading into my, once I head into my 6th year starting in February.
Nice. And I think I was reading in your newsletter recently that actually your readers think you should charge more.
Yeah.
In fact, for your subscriptions, which is a nice position, I suppose, for you to be in, Simon.
Yeah. Despite the fact that I create content about the business of content and the business of media, I'm actually a really bad business person myself. Like, you know, I charge less than my competitors for both subscriptions and advertising rates. I'm not good about like, you know, explaining the value that I bring. And so I'm like always just like undervaluing myself. And as a result, I definitely have not grown as fast as I probably could have if I were a slightly better business person.
And you still do the one-to-ones as part of your subscription tiers, don't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's a big part of what I do. Now there are more people doing it because they saw me doing it, which I'm glad that people are copying this. But, like, I just decided that if you got a paid subscription, you would get this, like, automated Calendly link where anybody who became a paid subscriber could book a half-hour phone call with me. And if you look at it, like, on a per-hour basis of what I'm making from that, you would think, oh, this is fiscally irresponsible, mm-hmm. because like, why are you giving someone a half hour of your time because they signed up for like a $10 a month subscription? But I think there's value beyond that. One, a lot of those people I talk to, they're paid subscribers because they work in media. A lot of them end up being contacts that I can, you know, leverage in my reporting, or I have them on my podcast and stuff like that. So it's a great way to meet people within the industry and kind of chat about what they're going through. Two, I think someone who talks to me on the phone is more likely to recommend me to their colleagues and remember me and you know, basically be a brand ambassador on my behalf. And then three, I think it significantly lowers churn rates. Like if you get on the phone with me, you have that personal connection, you're much less likely to unsubscribe. So that's kind of my motivation for doing that.
100%. Yeah. I mean, I can imagine how it informs so much of what you do. You know, from that opening call, what they're interested in, what their needs are, and so forth. And
yeah,
that feeds into your strategy as a whole.
And then also I do like these monthly office hours calls where I kind of invite on like a featured guest. And we just kind of talk about what's going on in their media business, but I'm able to call on people who are like watching that live and in a lot of cases know specifically what they're working on. So I can like call on people that I know would be good to speak to certain issues on that call. So like having that kind of knowledge of who these people, I don't 100% know every single person in the room because I might've forgotten or they might never have signed up for the call, but it does help me keep those calls to be a little bit more dynamic.
For sure. So 2024, we'll definitely get into some of the, at least what we see as some of the big pivotal moments in the media business and some of the things that have stood out to us. I'd like to start with a media publication here in the UK called Mill Media, which launched on Substack in 2020. And thanks to various Substack grants, they've been able to expand that model from Manchester into other UK metropolitan cities like Sheffield, Liverpool. And then earlier this year, of course, they got investment such that they were able to expand in Glasgow and then London with two industry veterans. And they're also able to migrate off Substack and onto Ghost as a platform. And so I kind of feel like this is quite significant. I know you've got a lot to say about Substack, Simon. I know you write a lot about it. But to me, here in the UK, look, UK News is crying out for innovation. And here's a UK publication that's really kind of managing to do that, you know, really by utilizing the best of platforms. I'm just wondering, is this something that you're seeing as well in the States in terms of publications that are finding, you know, at least their roots and their feet on platforms like Substack?
Yeah, I mean, less about like, I mean, I guess there are some local publications on Substack, but it is a trend that I'm seeing where, you know, someone who's in the community who might have a lot of experience within journalism, basically launching these extremely lean newsletter forward kind of publications. I think the newsletter component is a very important part of these models. And just basically growing organically and being part of the community. And I definitely have seen a lot of examples of like that kind of sprouting up within the US and kind of like organically growing into these areas that, you know, were previously known as news deserts. And I think in a lot of cases, they don't look like their legacy media predecessors. They're not very top heavy. They're, like I said, they're extremely lean. They only employ like a handful of journalists, most of whom actually live in the communities that they're reporting on. And they do a lot with very little. And I come from local newspapers originally, and we were able to cover a wide breadth of like news within the counties that we were covering with only three reporters. And so I think it's really encouraging to see what they're doing and what others are doing in the US. And I do think it represents a new model that we're going to see more of going forward.
It's interesting. I really want to get into that because I think one of the reasons I think it's significant, the Mill here in the UK, is that it is giving people a vote of confidence to do it in other areas of the UK on a sort of scaled down level. We're seeing examples of this little towns in Kent. We're seeing this in smaller areas up into the north of England. And when I speak to some of these publications, there's one called the Medway Authority, which is, you know, a really small part of the UK. They're saying, look, we've seen what the Mill's been able to do. We want to try it for ourselves. But Medway is not Manchester. And so there's kind of a scaling issue there to go over. But do you think this trend will bear out?
Yeah, I mean, I think Substack is just great because it's such an easy, like it's completely free to use and it's got like a really clean publishing platform and you can just like hit publish. You can worry about the content and then not really think about the tech or the design so much. So I think it's like a great starter pack for anybody who wants to experiment in this type of publishing. And then is his name Yoshi?
Yoshi. Yeah.
Just like he decided to do. He eventually, I guess, outgrew Substack and then moved onto a platform that was more customizable and everything like that. So like you always have that option. So I think you're going to see more and more of these publications at least start out on Substack, because it's just like such an easy, simple to use publishing platform that kind of gives you everything you need to do in order to, you know, produce high quality content and get it in front of, you know, an actual readership.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, he launched this in like COVID, and it was only after hitting 1,500 subscribers in Manchester, he was able to break even at that point. So it's not a huge volume of subscribers you need just to be able to cover your operating costs, to be honest.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I spoke to him, and naturally when you do these interviews, you ask, like, why Substack? His answer to that question was always, the day I don't want to be on Substack, I own that relationship, I can just export. And lo and behold, 4 years later, he's done exactly that. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely one of the kind of votes of confidence in using platforms like these. Is any of that coming across over in the States as well?
Yeah, totally. I mean, and that kind of dives into another trend that's going on with media right now, is like every media conference you go to, every time you speak to a media entrepreneur, like 10 years ago, they were talking about Facebook, they were talking about Twitter, and now they're only talking about their email lists, or talking about homepage visits, or talking about app downloads and stuff like that. But like this emphasis on owning your audience, where you can literally just hit a button and export an Excel file and then move your entire list onto a different platform, just as Yoshi has done. And so I think that's increasingly appealing to publishers who have been screwed over time and time again from decreasing Facebook traffic, from decreasing Google traffic. So I think that whole ethos of, oh, if I don't like this, I can just move over here and not pay a penalty, I think that's really huge.
Yeah, I think he had his fair amount of detractors, to be honest, in the early days, of saying, why would you predicate your entire business on like a tech platform, basically? And I think this is a fair justification for doing that, to be fair.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I'm kind of actually writing a little bit about this right now. It's like this debate, you know, Substack, what's the point of being on that versus, you know, Ghost or something where you have 100% control over design or WordPress or name your publishing platform. I think it comes down to Substack is trying to kind of like merge together two different worlds, the benefit of a social media platform with the benefits of a, you know, email platform where you can own your audience. And I think it's doing a really good job in creating kind of a differentiated product that is helping people grow their audiences while also still owning them. But I'm happy to talk about some of the features that it's using to do that.
Well, you know, because you use Substack, right? So yeah, elaborate if you would.
Yeah, so like starting in 2022 or 23, I want to say, they first launched this like recommendations feature where any Substack writer could recommend other Substack publications that they like, so that when someone signs up for their newsletter, they're taken to a screen where it says, this writer has recommended these other newsletters. Do you want to sign up for that? And so you can just click an easy button, and then all of a sudden you're now signed up for those newsletters as well. So that generated a huge boost in growth for a lot of writers, me included. And then ever since then, Substack has then like grown, basically launched its own social network called Substack Notes. It's been really kind of investing in its app and trying to just get people into the Substack ecosystem. So now, you know, whenever I post stuff I just used to post to Twitter, I now cross post to Substack Notes. And so I'm getting a lot of engagement within Substack Notes. It's allowing me to like touch my audience on a more frequent basis in between sending out my newsletter, and that kind of is organically leading people to clicking on my profile and looking at my Substack and signing up. So like I now, you know, have gotten probably north of 10,000 signups just driven within the Substack, its own ecosystem at this point. And I think something like 50% of signups on Substack newsletters are coming from within Substack's own platform, meaning that like the platform itself is playing some role in driving those signups. And I think the last figure I saw was 30% of paid subscriptions are coming from those internal recommendation tools. So these are real people who are finding your newsletter by virtue of you being on Substack. And that's growth that you wouldn't necessarily get from being on just WordPress and MailChimp or Ghost and stuff like that.
Yeah. I think that point about the circular user base in terms of recommendations is kind of pivotal in something I want to come onto next, which is kind of a big body blow to independent news here in the UK with the closure of the Lincolnite, which, for anyone who doesn't know, an independent local news organisation set up in Lincoln, which sadly kind of went bust this year. And really, they were doing all the right things in terms of investing in their own tech. They got their own investment. And the challenge they wanted to overcome is to move people from a free relationship really onto a paid relationship after, you know, operating for free for 9 years. But when I spoke to Daniel Ionescu about this, he kind of said, well, that was one of the key mistakes we made. We weren't able to really move people across. We only managed to convert about 1% of our reader base over to a paid. And ultimately, we just ran out of runway. And so they, this kind of new app that they developed just didn't really work at all. And so it was one of the big moments this year that I found quite gutting, really, for the independent news media here in the UK. And that's kind of such a tricky question for news organizations now. If you haven't launched with a freemium, like you maybe find on Substack, how do you move people across into that paid relationship?
If I remember correctly, he was like trying to do something a little bit more ambitious, though. Like, was he trying to build some kind of app that was pulling in a bunch of other local publications and stuff like that?
Yeah. It was called My Local.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, I'm not speaking from any like great depth of knowledge about this particular company, but you could say, was that a distraction? Was that a big investment? Like, would that $500,000 or whatever he spent developing that app better have been spent in like investing in, you know, his actual like local publication and just making that really good and using that to hire reporters or something to really kind of strengthen the value and the connection to the audience? I don't know, you know, specifically, but that doesn't really ring true to me, this idea that like, oh, you were free for this long, so you can't convert into, you can't go to paid because your audience is too used to the free. I think like lots of publications have launched paid products after being free, you know, the most famous example being the New York Times.
But who's done that on an independent or local level?
What's it called? Berkeley Side, I think it's called, and City Side. They didn't put anything behind a paywall, but I think they launched like completely ad supported and was completely free and didn't really kind of like, there are a lot of publications that are Mission Local. There's a lot of publications that started out as just completely free publications and have launched some kind of membership that's now kind of, you know, generating significant revenue for their publications. Because the public is somewhat aware about news deserts and the fact that like local news is disappearing, I think a lot of like especially locally owned outlets are able to get a lot of mileage by not actually locking much stuff behind a paywall and instead appealing to, if you want local news in your community, you need to become a member. So I think there's a debate going over there too, is like, are paywalls even necessary? And would you be better just keeping all your content for free and just having more kind of like messaging that's almost like the public radio fundraiser type of messaging of like, you need to support local news because local news supports your local community. And this is only $5 a month and yada, yada, yada. So there's some debates on like how to approach the actual paid subscriptions versus membership problem for local news as well.
Tell me about the big closure of the year over in the US, the Messenger. What happened there?
Yeah, so the Messenger was a big bet, they raised like $50 million. It was a guy named, I think his name was Jimmy Finkelstein or Finkelstein. He had previously owned a newspaper here called The Hill, which he got out right at the right time. I think he sold it for like over $100 million, and it was kind of the peak of the zero interest. It was one of the last of the great media acquisitions before kind of the market crashed. And the Messenger was really kind of built on that like early 2010s thinking, you know, back when BuzzFeed and Vice and Mike and all these companies were raising, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in VC funding. This idea of like, let's just go wide, let's just like leverage, you know, put out as much content as possible, and we'll basically ride this wave of free social media and Google traffic. And then once we reach certain level of scale, then we can convert that into advertising dollars. And it was a business model that just felt anachronistic almost from the very get-go, because everybody else who worked in media already knew by the time it launched that that model had already been proven to be, you know, based on just faulty metrics and this idea that the tech platforms would always like send, you know, unlimited traffic. So So people were predicting it was going to fail before it even launched. They were saying this, you know, this is the BuzzFeed model, this is the Vice model. It's already proven that it can't work. And sure enough, they burned through $50 million in cash in something like, it was less than a year. I forget what it was. This was kind of a determination that this doesn't work. And, you know, obviously BuzzFeed's really struggling right now. It had to offload Complex Media. It just now offloaded Hot Ones. And then Vice had filed for bankruptcy this year and laid off most of its staff. Really, that kind of model of scale for scale's sake has really proven out to be, you know, a huge, incredibly bad bet that was made in the early 2000s. And all those chickens have come home to roost this year.
In 2024, heading into 2025, what do you think determines whether a media organization lives or dies?
I think owning, you know, owning your audience, having a real business model from the very get-go. Like, I think one of the big problems that sites like The Messenger and Vice and BuzzFeed ran into is they had so much money that they could just burn through it without worrying, like, what's going to happen when this money goes away. So, like, scaling will still happen and growth will still happen, but, like, responsible growth based on, you know, actual, you know, fundamentals, that'll be, you know, a big part of it. I think media companies, as they increasingly are now competing with creators and independent media companies, like, they're going to have to become more lean. We're going to see, Condé Nast just like fired a bunch of like very high level, well into the six figure salary, you know, senior vice presidents of revenue and everything like that. I think a lot of media companies are still, especially legacy media companies, are still very top heavy. Just like in the new media economy, you just can't generate enough revenue to like have this huge overhead, which I think is a good thing. Like, I think like media companies are like slowly becoming more efficient and focusing on like the actual content and what value can we actually deliver.
Yeah, that's interesting, Simon, because I think that's one thing that's really come through in this year's sort of journalism predictions for next year, is that new media outlets and entrepreneurial journalists and content creators understand this paradigm shift a whole lot more than traditional media and sort of legacy media. And sort of this idea that they might give them a run for their money somehow. I mean, do you think that's exaggerated or do you think that's actually quite true?
No, I think it is quite true. Like, if you've been following, you know, along with U.S. politics this year, this was a really big year for independent media. Like, you keep on hearing this term, the podcast election. And I think it's really kind of this was the first election where the mainstream media, like I have this phrase, the term mainstream media has become an anachronism in the sense that there isn't a mainstream media anymore. Like, there are independent YouTubers and podcasts that have way more reach and much bigger audiences than, you know, the top, you know, anchors at the biggest news organizations. I mean, you look at like someone like Joe Rogan or Alex Cooper, just the audio versions of their podcasts are like 10 million listeners per episode. And that's not even counting like the views on YouTube and stuff like that. You know, I regularly come across YouTubers who have, even like mid-sized YouTubers that only have like 3 million subscriber channels, that are regularly getting 4 million views per video that they put out, where they're just literally doing what we're doing now, just staring into their camera and just kind of speaking extemporaneously and then editing that down. And they have more viewership than, you know, Anderson Cooper at CNN, who's only getting like 600,000 viewers a night. So it's just like, I think there's just greater recognition now that that independent media has just as much reach, in fact, way more reach collectively than the entirety of like the mainstream media.
Who do you think is getting this right at the moment in the States? Like, who is best in class in terms of understanding and owning their audience and really leveraging that in a smart way?
I think, have you heard of a publication called Puck?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Puck is an interesting model in that it's kind of taking a lot of these principles of the the creator economy of, like, you know, taking these star writers who would, you know, if they went off there on their own and launched on like Substack or something, they would be able to make very good livings for themselves. And they're saying, hey, instead of you going off and launching your own thing, what if we band together and we'll give you equity, we'll give you, you know, a cut of the revenue, but we'll also give you the institutional support you get from traditional media companies like health insurance, marketing support, editing support. And it's almost like a new approach to talent versus the top-down model where it's like, these people are all making $1 million a year and these people are making only $50,000 a year. And, you know, they're interchangeable and fireable and can be laid off at any moment versus this puck model where it's like, you know, you are the talent, you're driving all the value for the company. So you should get a piece of the upside if the company succeeds. So that's like a really interesting, you know,
that really feels like flipping the pyramid, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. So you're starting to see the emergence of these writer collectives or writer cooperatives where basically a bunch of writers, usually who maybe worked at the mainstream media publication, they break off, they either get laid off or they all quit en masse and then launch a new publication where they all have ownership of it. You know, one of the most famous examples was Defector, which it was entirely staffed in the beginning with people who worked at Deadspin, which was a really famous sports publication owned by Gawker Media. I think they're completely, you know, transparent with their financials. They're making, was it $2 million a year, $4 million a year now? And every single one of their writers, you know, makes a minimum of like $75,000 a year. There's 404 Media, which was several tech writers who wrote for Vice. They broke off and launched their own publication. They're now generating, I think the latest figure is $700,000 a year through subscriptions. And that's only divided between four people. So that's, you know, every single one of them is making over $100,000 a year. There's Hellgate, which is a local experiment, you know, based in New York. That's a writer cooperative. So I think there's like more and more of these media companies that are launching where everybody who is contributing to the company has some kind of ownership in the company, and they're more incentivized to stick with the company and also help it grow because they get to benefit from any success the company has.
Yeah, it seems to solve a number of challenges at once, right?
Yeah.
Because then you're not worried about this exodus of talent. You know, they're actually creating value for the company. It's a fascinating trend, and I suppose one that you'll be keeping a close eye on next year.
For sure.
Just while we're on the topic of sort of new media publications who really sort of understand and leverage their audience in a meaningful way, I mean, one of the most drawn out media stories here in the UK was the acquisition of The Observer by Tortoise. I'm not sure if you've seen much on this, but this is a five-year-old startup which has raised £25 million to acquire one of the world's oldest newspapers going back to the 1700s with a view of turning it into a digitally savvy outfit and in line with their own sort of editorial output, you know, more focused on investigations, podcasting, and so forth. I mean, it is symptomatic, I think, of what you just described there, really, which is this growing trend of just, you know, importance of understanding and owning your audience.
Well, I just don't understand that, you know, and this is someone who doesn't follow UK media as closely, is I didn't understand why there was such an uproar. Because, like, as far as I understood, Tortoise is a well-regarded brand that's, like, actually, you know, focused on quality journalism versus, you know, some of these legacy media brands that are just, like, still doing, like, you know, throwing everything at the wall to see what sticks and churning out just like a lot of low quality information. Why was there such an uproar in the UK over that?
This is a good question. I think one of them was they just felt that the future of The Observer was better in the hands of the Guardian Media Group, that they didn't really trust this startup to dictate its future. But I think there's also an ideological problem there, is that they felt that they were basically arming Tortoise with a really powerful competitor, The Guardian. In other words, you know, they'd be essentially selling off a really valuable part of their company to one of their up-and-coming rivals.
I mean, certainly The Guardian has a lot more money to burn through the Scott Trust to keep it alive versus if Tortoise Media maybe makes a bad bet, it won't have the cash reserves to pivot and keep it going or something.
Just a quick fire round just to cap things off here. What was your favorite media story of the year that you followed?
I continue to follow these writer-owned collectives, and every time I see one of them launch out of a publication, an already existing publication that, you know, is known for mistreating its writers or undervaluing them, it just makes me feel good, because I do think that kind of represents a future for media, is because, like, there's this whole debate. It's like, oh, Substack is great if you already have, you know, a huge following, but it really is a grind to, you know, build an audience up from scratch and monetize it to a full-time living. I'm the embodiment of that. I'm now almost 5 years into my journey, and I'm still struggling to, like, really, like, fully monetize my audience. And I'm still not making as much money as I did back when I was just doing, like, content consulting and stuff like that. So I'm, you know, I'm someone who kind of started this, who didn't have a big audience to start with. So I had to spend the last, like, 5 years grinding it out to build that audience. So I think these writer cooperatives, like, what is it? The whole is the greater than the sum of its parts, or whatever that saying is, where by banding together and kind of cross-pollinating audiences and resources and stuff like that, they can scale and grow much quicker and get to a sustainable level much quicker than those individual writers could do if they were on their own. So I think that's, like, a hugely encouraging trend that we're seeing, is a lot of creators kind of teaming up in really interesting ways.
Nice. What's top of your wish list for Christmas in a professional capacity?
In a professional capacity? I mean, from a physical point of view, like, my podcast has a video component, and for the longest time, it's driven me crazy. I moved into a new house.
Yep.
It's driven me crazy how boring my background is. And so I finally got a bookshelf here, and I'm going to start hanging up. I have a bunch of art that I'm going to order and have it all over here, and maybe get some better lighting and stuff like that. And then eventually I'd like to, like, right now I'm speaking through a webcam that's just came with my laptop. I'd get to get a better webcam with, like, higher quality video. So that's a big wish list for me from, like, a physical perspective. Yeah. From a business model perspective, I'd like to figure out the advertising side of my business, and then figure out, you know, what's going to convert even more people into paid subscribers, because I think paid subscribers are going to be, you know, continue to be the biggest part of making my business sustainable.
Well, you and me both, for the backgrounds, I mean, that's the reason there's no video on our podcast for the time being. But here's hoping that your Christmas wishes come true, Simon. Thanks for coming on the show. I've really appreciated it.
Thank you, and happy holidays.
The takeaway for today is this: watch out for independent new media going into 2025. Why? Because these lean and nimble organizations are very, very good at owning and leveraging their audience, and that is going to be a critical trend next year. Many of these newsrooms are purpose-built to be much closer to their audience than legacy media. Look at Tortoise and how fitting it is they've now completed the acquisition of The Observer, the world's largest newspaper. A fascinating statement of the times we're living in. Platforms like Substack are enabling this shift to great effect as well, and they're good starter packs in order to build an audience and then migrate when the time is right. We saw just that with The Mill. Classic challenges still exist. Getting people to pay for news will still be a major hurdle to clear, and has proven to be the big undoing of independent media, like Lincolnite's indie local news provider, The Lincolnite. The other classic challenge is being stuck in the past and not adapting. Simon talked about how The Messenger failed because it pursued an expensive scale-based business model that is no longer fit for purpose. Lots to keep an eye on 2025, and you can bet we'll be right across it. You know where to find me if you'd like to chat. I'm on LinkedIn, or email me on jacob@journalism.co.uk. But that's all we have time for this week. And whether you've been listening all year or just for the last 5 minutes, thank you so much for checking out the show. Till next time.